The power of intent. How many times have you strived for something? You just didn't do it right. But the power of intent, you can accomplish incredible things. Up next, Stephen Schwartz, and we talk about the power of intent on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Schwartz, Research Associate of Cognitive Sciences Laboratory of the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, happens to be one of the world's experts in remote viewing and intent. For almost 20 years, he has been the research director and chairman of the Mobius Society as well and founder of the Society for Anthropology of Consciousness. Here he is, back on Coast to Coast, Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, how are you?
How are you, George? Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure to have you back too, my friend. What's new?
Well, I guess what's new is I've been doing a lot of work on, just as you were saying, the power of intention, and most recently have been doing a study on applied kinesiology, muscle testing, which is a technique that's practiced by thousands and thousands of people all over the country. And I wanted to find out if it worked.
Now, explain that, kinesiology, a little bit.
Well, kinesiology dates back to the early part of the 20th century. It's it was designed originally by two researchers who discovered that there was a relationship between consciousness and the mind, and began to work with it in medical terms. But then about 20 years later, that was in the 40s, about 20 years later, a chiropractor by the name of Goodhart.
I love that name.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty good name, too. Anyway, a very interesting man. It was Michigan chiropractor George Goodhart. He began working with it with the idea that it could be used for a diagnostic technique. He developed a technique for tugging on particular muscle trigger points to restore function, and then began to take it up into testing for diagnostic purposes. And that technique, which has become codified, I guess would be the way to call it, by two institutions, the International College of Applied Kinesiology and the Touch for Health Movement, grew up, in which basically the idea is you hold some substance and they do a muscle test. Typically, you extend your arm out, and the practitioner, the health practitioner who is testing you, presses down, and presumably things which are good for you, you remain strong, and things which are bad for you, your muscle gets weak. And
interesting.
And they demonstrate this, and it's very dramatic. My question was, was it a reliable diagnostic test? That's what I wanted to know. I had no doubt that it would work sometimes with some people, but the question was, if it's a diagnostic test, you know, when you go in to have a pregnancy test, you don't want to get a, well, it might be and it might not be answer. So a friend of mine, actually another one of the founders of remote viewing, Russell Targ, called me up one day and asked me if what I knew about applied kinesiology and did I think it was viable as a diagnostic test. And I told him I knew what everybody knows, that is, there are thousands of people who do this all the time, and there are a great number of people who practice it and go to school and all that. But as to whether it really was a viable test, I couldn't answer that question. I told him, and he said, well, I've got a friend who's about to make a serious health decision on the basis of this, and I'm just very concerned that he make the right choice. So after I hung up, I got to thinking about it and began to read a little bit about it, and I realized that nobody had ever done a really definitive study on it, and so I organized a study which was funded by the Bial Foundation, and over the last year carried out a study involving 50 patients who were tested by two kinesiologists, a man and a woman.
And explain again how they would use kinesiology, this muscle testing as a sure. way to determine their body function.
Sure. Well, let's say that you went into a health professional and they said, well, George, let's see whether tomatoes are good for you. So you would hold a tomato in your hand.
And I would say tomato.
That's because you don't come from Virginia.
No, but then you're supposed to say potato, potato. Come on. You know the song. I've waited
true.
10 years for someone to say that so
well,
I could use that
go.
Line.
You're holding that line in reserve,
yep.
and there you got to use it.
And I popped it on you, but all right, go ahead.
Anyway, so you'd be holding the tomato, and you'd extend your arm out, and they would press down on your arm, and presumably, if the tomato was good for you, your arm would remain strong, and if the tomato was bad for you, then your arm would be weak. And
huh.
as I say, this is people demonstrate this all the time, and it seems very dramatic.
How does it work?
Well, that's what I wanted to know. I mean, that was one of my questions: is how does it work? If it works, how does it work? I mean,
is the body doing it or is the individual
well,
doing it?
That was the question. Who is the agent of action?
Right.
Is it the practitioner, the chiropractor or naturopath or whatever it was, MD, who is doing the testing? Are they the agent of action or is it you yourself who is the agent of action? I didn't know the answer to that. And nobody seemed to know the answer to that. Not really. And so that was one of the things that I built into the design of this study, was to find out who is the agent of action. The other thing I wanted to know was, could it be done under double-blind conditions where nobody knew the answer? Because the way it's practiced in most clinical situations, is the practitioner has a pretty good idea of what they think the outcome is, and they do the test, and so there's no blindness to it. There's no objective verification. And so I designed a study where people carried out these tests in the clinical setting. I got a chiropractor to loan me her clinic so that we could do it. I tried to make it as absolutely equivalent to a normal therapeutic session that you would experience if you were a patient and went into any one of thousands of practitioners who do this.
Huh.
But I did it under double-blind conditions. That is, no one knew the answer to the question that was going to be asked. And I tried to make it, I didn't want to use something like a tomato because, you know, some people like tomatoes and some people don't.
Right.
I wanted something that was really very clear cut. So it was an either or answer. So I had researchers in Colorado, my colleagues who participated in this study with me, I had them prepare a series of 300 vials, half of which, they were all filled with a normal saline solution, which they made so that there would be no question of was there some trace element in it.
Right, right.
So, and into half of those vials of saline solution, which is good for you, I had them introduce a poison so that it was as clear-cut a situation. The question was, is this harmful for you? Harmful to you, and of course the answer for normal saline would be it would be positive, and the answer for the poison is no, of course it would not be good for you. And they prepared these bottles and randomly numbered them and sent them to another researcher in New York, and he assigned two bottles, one treated bottle, that is, had the poison, and one control bottle, that is, just had normal saline. They were all had just little numbers on them. And he put them into plastic envelopes and assigned them to each of the sessions that we were going to have with these people. And I got 50 people who volunteered, most of whom had been using kinesiology, not
mm-hmm.
all, but most of them, who were highly educated in some cases, a number of them. All of them were conversant with the idea of kinesiology. And I got three kinesiologists, two women and a man, all of whom were diplomats from their trainings. One was at Dutch for Health. The others were International College of Kinesiology. And so I wanted to get highly skilled people. I didn't want there to be any criticism about, well, you didn't get somebody that really knew what he was doing, that kind of thing. I didn't know which vial was the treated vial or which was the control, nor did any of the kinesiologists, nor did the people being tested. So we're all completely blind to this. And to answer the question as to who was the agent of action, I thought, well, if it was the practitioner, then they would be exerting perhaps more force when they got to the poison vial than when they got to the control vial. So in order to address that issue, I got an instrument that fits on the palm of the hand, which measures in grams, the amount of pressure that is being exerted so that I could get in real time. And so I got a graph of each session as to how much pressure was being exerted by the kinesiologist to see whether they were the agent of action if it worked. And as I said, I put it together so that it took place in a chiropractor's clinic, just like most kinesiology sessions do. Most kinesiologists are chiropractors, not all, but many of them. And you came in just as you would come into a regular treatment session.
Sure.
And you filled out the paperwork just as you would if you were a first patient. And then you came in and you were first tested by one kinesiologist. And then after a wait of about 40 minutes, you were tested by the second kinesiologist. And then just to see what would happen if there was no kinesiologist present and the agent of action was the person being treated, I had them come in and do a third session with a little gadget that measures the amount of pressure that you can exert when you make a fist, a thing called a hand dynamometer. And so there were three conditions: a male kinesiologist, a female kinesiologist, and the hand dynamometer. And for each one of those sessions, I had two new vials so that the vials were only used one time. Each session contained a poison vial and a saline vial. And so we ran this. We had 50 people volunteer. And I have to tell you, somewhat to my surprise, it didn't work.
It did not work.
And so I would not be able to recommend on the basis of this that kinesiology is a test that you should use to make a health decision. Now, I do believe that some kinesiologists, under certain circumstances, are probably highly accurate. But, of course, you as a patient don't know which is which. And I also think that people who practice sort of personal kinesiology, you can see them in restaurants making a little circle of their first finger and their thumb and then trying to pull them apart about making decisions about what to eat. That kind of kinesiology I think of as a form of dowsing. And it's a kind of biophysical feedback mechanism, like a biofeedback. And the measure is the strength of the fingers that you're exerting. The issue that I particularly wanted to look at was if kinesiology works, if I put the poison in these little vials, as is usually done, typically if you're doing it with a kinesiologist, they'll take a little vial that has some supplement, for instance, iron I don't know, sulfur or something, and you hold the little vial and they test you. So in those circumstances where the person never actually touches the physical substance, the only way that this could possibly work would be that there would be some kind of non-local connection. That is, we know that people are in communication, that all life is interconnected and interdependent. That's what makes all non-local experiences like clairvoyance or precognition possible. So my presumption was that somehow there was a linkage between the patient and the practitioner which allowed them to have a knowingness of which was which, since they never, the patient never actually touched the poison or in the normal circumstance, whatever the supplement would be.
Would you say that this failed, even though it didn't work?
Well, that's, you know, a very interesting question. I got asked. I just presented this paper a week ago at the University of Washington at the Parapsychological Association meetings, and that was one of the questions that I got asked. And my answer to that, because I thought a lot about this, mostly my experiments work. There are there are people like Russ Targ or Dean Radin, all of whom have been on your show, myself. Jim Spottiswood, there's a handful of people at May. Almost all of their experiments work. And then there are other researchers who do this, and their experiments either don't work or work very, very slightly. So it was unusual for me to have an experiment fail, but I think the operative point here, speaking of intention, was that for a month before I did this experiment, normally when I do, like, my archaeological projects where we try to locate something on archaeological sites.
We're going to talk a little bit about that
later. Yeah, I want these to succeed. But in this case, what I wanted was the truth. And so for 30 days prior to doing this study, I meditated on holding the intention that this study would produce the valid truth about the question, is this a viable diagnostic test? And so I don't see, because it didn't reach statistical significance, at one level, I mean, you would say, well, it failed, but at another level, I don't think that at all. I think it answered the question, which I had asked. And so I see this experiment as highly successful. And in fact, I would even go further and say, it is my belief that many of the holistic medical practices that people use ought to be subjected to similar studies. Because we need to know what part of holistic medicine really does work. You know, there's also a big issue about placebo effect.
I mean, sure.
We know that in any medical drug trial, for instance, that about on average across many, many trials, and there are thousands of them, about 35% of the people who participate in a drug trial who get the sugar pill still produce a result as good or better than the people who get the medication.
Exactly, and in many cases as better.
Absolutely. And clearly that is telling us that, which I hope we'll get into a little bit about how self-healing issues, but that is clearly telling us that we have the ability to control our bodies down to the cellular level, down to the subcellular, because it has to do with tiny amounts of substances of various kinds that cause the cells to react in a certain way. And so we clearly have the ability to control our bodies down to a level that was never conceived of in materialist science. When you read, for instance, the reports of explorers like Alexandra David Neal, who went over and saw the Tibetans back in the end of the 19th century and came back with these reports of these extraordinary physical capabilities that these Tibetan monks had, and everybody poo-pooed it and just dismissed her as, you know, a lunatic and a bad observer. Well, it turns out that most of those things that she reported that have now been tested, that every time they get tested, it turns out she was right. She was accurately reporting. And when you see the placebo literature, clearly, I mean, if we were doing a drug trial, you and I had physicians who set up to do, for instance, let's say a drug trial on some kind of pancreatic medication. Well, most people couldn't even tell you where their pancreas was, let alone what it did. And yet, we know that if we do such a study, that we will expect 35% of the people who get the sugar pill to do as well or better than the people that get the medication. Well, how do they do that? How do they know where their pancreas is? How do they know exactly what to do to mimic the results that are produced by the medication? Well, clearly there is a great deal more going on than materialism alone can explain.
And let's talk more about intent when we come right back. Well, if you haven't signed up for StreamLink yet, you may do so by going to coasttocoastam.com, where you get podcasting and downloads and the ability to listen to the show whenever you want. And you can also go back into the archives now for 1 year past for downloading programs, and soon that'll be 2 years past. Stephen, let's talk about the power of intent. You know, on Fridays, we have this power of intent where people pray, use their consciousness for the good of others. And I mean, there seems to be some very remarkable things happening here. What are we tapping into? What's that source?
We're tapping into the non-local domain, that part of us which is outside of space-time and which is everywhere. I mean, it's think of it as the cosmic internet, in a sense. You know, when you talk to somebody else via computer, you have a Macintosh and they have a PC. Well, that computers don't speak directly to themselves. What happens is that you send out a message which is broken into thousands of tiny little packets and sent out all over the place in every which direction, and which come together sort of, for most of us, magically at the other end, and the PC computer can read them. Well, this isn't a perfect analogy, and I don't want to get stuck with it, but in a very real sense, it's very much like the internet. We are all workstations on this cosmic internet. Some of our computers are more powerful than others. Some of them are handled with greater facility than others. But we are all part of the net. And when we hold a clear intention, what we know from the research, and again, you know, I speak only from peer-reviewed, double-blind research. That's my basis.
That's what drives you.
Yeah, I love speculations, and I love stories, but at the end of the day, what I care about is data that has been obtained through proper testing and protocols. And I believe that matters which were previously thought of as spiritual are completely susceptible to this kind of testing. People don't like to do it because it conflicts with their dogma, but nonetheless, these kinds of intention experiments that are intention experiences that you have organized, first of all, I think, are quite powerful.
Yes.
When you get a large group of people to hold a common intention, things happen. Now, they don't necessarily happen in a clearly causal way because it's not linear like that. That's just very sort of constrained linear thinking. But you set in motion choices that people will make, little choices. I mean, if you think about, let's take one that we all are familiar with. If you look at smoking in the United States, now, I'm a little older than you are, but both of us clearly remember the days when you went over to somebody's house and they had a pack of cigarettes in a little container on the coffee table.
Mm-hmm.
And
just pulled them out.
Smoked, and there were ashtrays all over the house, right?
Yeah, except me. I didn't smoke.
Well, okay, George. Anyway, actually, I didn't. I was never attracted to cigarettes.
You didn't smoke either.
I didn't get cigarettes.
Nah.
But in any case, in 1964, the Surgeon General came out with a report about smoking was not good for you.
Right.
And if you think about it, within 40 years, hundreds of millions of people made a decision not to smoke.
Cities are now banning smoking.
Absolutely. And the idea, you know, that smoking is cool. I mean, kids still smoke. There's no question people continue to start. God knows the tobacco companies are certainly making it as accessible as possible. But the truth is, because of intention, there was a change in the culture. And yet, you'd be hard-pressed to try to say, well, what got George Norrie's brother-in-law's third cousin to quit smoking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he read something, he heard something. No, I mean, all of that may be true, but what happened was he clicked into an intention which was growing, reaching a kind of critical mass, and he made a personal decision. And when you organize people to hold a common intention, you get results. They don't, as I say, they're not always sort of obviously causal, but you just see things change. Roger Nelson, who was part of the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Group, who I think has also been on your show.
Yeah, sure has.
Roger talks, you know, who directs the Global Consciousness Project, where he's looking at how people's intentionality, when it's strongly held, is highly numinous, that is, has a highly charged emotional quality, causes perturbations in random number generators that are scattered all over the world. And they show they become non-random for a brief period of time, correlated with something like Princess Diana's death. Well, we're beginning to get a sense of this. I mean, what is exciting, I think, is we're finally beginning to understand, not just experientially, but also scientifically, that we are all interconnected and interdependent. And when it doesn't work for some of us, at some level, it's not working for any of us. And I think we can see smoking being an example of how major cultural changes can happen. And they start with intention. When you go back and look at every major socially progressive development in the history of the United States, penal reform, public education, women's rights, abolition of slavery, for instance, and you go back to those things, you'll find at the core of them a little bitty group of Quakers. Now, the Quakers are a religious denomination that are so tiny, there are only about 158,000 of them today in a country of about 330 million.
Nixon was one.
Yes, I know, to the endless shame of the Quakers. But in any case, the Quakers are such a tiny little group. Most people have never met one, never will meet one, don't know anything about them. If you don't live in Pennsylvania or Maryland, Ohio, places where there are large Quaker groupings, you just don't encounter them. And yet, when you go back and trace the development of all of these things that made a big difference in our world, you find out there's a little group of Quakers at the core of it, demonstrating that a small group of people, and goodness knows your audience is many, many times larger than the entire Quaker community. I mean, you're in the millions, and you know they're in the hundreds, just over 100,000. When you can focus with a clear intention, it's getting the clear intention is the hard part. When you can get people to focus a clear intention toward a commonly agreed upon goal, things happen.
And they let it go. Just let it go. Don't push it.
That's right. You have to, one of the rules of how this works, you and I talked about this on an earlier program, one of the rules about how this works is you must be willing to do it even though you know you're never going to get credit for it. You must be willing to do it, even though you're never going to see in your own lifetime the final results of it. You have to incorporate it into your beingness. You know, before he was assassinated, Mahatma Gandhi did an interview with a young reporter from the Times of India that had been sent up to his ashram, and this kid asked him, you know, I came up here to ask one question for my editors, and the question, he said, well, ask the question. The question was, how did you force the British to leave India? You don't have any money, you never had a position, you don't command any armies, you're not a public official. How did you force them to leave India, where they had been, I might add, for 350 years at that point, longer than the United States has existed? And Gandhi's answer speaks directly to this intention issue. He said, it wasn't what we did that was important, but that was important. It wasn't what we said that was important, but that was important. It was the nature of our beingness. That is the essence of our character, we would describe it in the West, that made the British choose to leave India. And so I applaud what you are doing. I hope you're focusing on some of the egregious issues which face our country today, global warming, the green transition, that sort of thing.
We haven't pushed it in that direction yet, Stephen, but I'm thinking about things like that.
Well, I will tell you, you know, I do a daily web report, the Schwartz Report, on trends that are affecting the future. And,
right.
And I look at this stuff every single day, and I got to tell you, my take is we have got to get clear about the transition out of petroleum, not only because of global climate change, although that for sure, but also because we are never going to be able to have a peaceful world as long as it's driven by petroleum and all the instabilities that petroleum produces.
Let's talk a little bit about your work in the remote viewing area. And on one of our past shows, you talked about your 2050 project. Explain that again for us, Stephen.
Oh, well, yes, that's actually become more and more interesting to me. Well, in 1978, having recently left government, I had been in government, and had been doing geopolitical analysis and things like that, so I had a pretty good idea of sort of what the official take on the world was. I was very concerned we were going to blow ourselves up. If you remember, this is back just as the nuclear freeze movement was beginning. This yeah. is when movies like The Day After Tomorrow about the nuclear holocaust were happening. And you know, there was, I mean, people don't think much about it now, but there was a real genuine fear that there was going to be a cataclysmic confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States. And I wanted to know, having been one of the creators of remote viewing, what remote viewing might be able to tell us about this. And so I put together a protocol. I chose the year 2050. The reason I chose that year is that it was on the other side of the 2012 predictions and all of that, all that sort of stuff. And it was far enough out that I could not linearly predict what people would say. That is, I couldn't extrapolate from what was known now to what was going to happen. But it was not so far out that I couldn't understand what people were saying. I mean, if I'd been in the 18th century and I'd gotten a description of a television, I mean, good heavens, what would I have made of that?
Sure.
You know, there's a box on your table with little people dancing around. I mean, you know, there are pygmies that they've bred. I mean, who knows? Anyway, so I chose 2050 as being far enough out that it got through all of these predictions, but not so far out that I couldn't understand what people were saying. And I began asking ordinary people, just like your listeners, to participate by doing a session in which I would take them through. I eventually made a CD on it so that people could, you know, I couldn't do everybody. and I asked people to go forward in time to whatever day day and month it was at the time that they did it. So today would be like the 24th of August,
mm-hmm.
2050.
2050, right.
And I would say to them, all right, they'd be lying down and with their eyes closed, and I would say, okay, I want you to go forward in time. You're standing in front of the place where you live. It's all very personal because we know that people describe personal experiences with greater detail than anything else. So I said, you're standing in front of the place where you live. I guess I should add that about 12% of the people were not incarnate. And so I would say to them, go find somebody whose eyes you can see this through, who you feel sympathetic with. But anyway, you're standing in front of the place where you live. Look down at your feet. What do you see? So they would describe for me, you know, I'm standing outside, I have shoes on. I would say, what kind of shoes? And they would describe those. And I would say, okay, now I want you to go into the space where you live. Now you'll notice I'm not saying house. I'm not saying apartment. I'm not building into my question any cueing that I'm looking for. This is the problem with a lot of the abduction stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what did sure. they do to you after they took you up in the spaceship? That's a hopeless question. So I would say you're now inside the place where you live, where you sleep. what does it look like? And they would describe that. And then they would go into considerable detail about it and take them around all the, is there more than one room in this space where you live? Yes, go into the various rooms, describe them for me. Then I would say, go to the place where you spend most of your waking hours. Now, I don't say where you work, because I didn't know whether people worked. I just said, go to the space where you spend most of your waking time. And then, okay, you're standing outside of it. What does the door look like? How many floors are there to this structure that you spend your time in? And people would describe that. And then I would say, okay, I want you to go into the into this structure. What do you see? And so forth, and where they work and what they did and all that sort of thing. I would ask them things like, how do you pay for things?
How do you travel?
How do you communicate? If you want to get in touch with somebody who is dear to you but not physically proximate to you, how do you do that? And I would say, I want you to go to a place where health care is delivered. Again, notice, not a hospital, not a clinic. Go to a place where health care is delivered. Describe it. Same thing. You're outside. Go inside. What do you see? Walk. They would say with things like, well, I'm in the corridor, and I'd say, okay, go down the corridor. Look to your left. What do you see? Look to your right. It's all very homey kind of questions. These are not, I'm not trying to get philosophical, political, any of that. It's very nitty-gritty. What do you wear? What do you eat? What do you do? What do you do when you go out with your friends? How do you travel? Blah, blah, blah. And over the years now, I have been doing that since 1978. I now have about 4,000 of these sessions, and I'm having them entered into a database, which is a big, complicated job that's being done for me by a wonderful woman named Mary Boyd. And already, there are a number of things which have come out of this. I mean, this, for instance, the 2050s, as I think of them collectively, and I have done this in the United States, in Canada, in Russia, in Japan, in Mexico, in Jamaica.
Do you get similar results?
That I wanted to see. And the answer is, I get almost the same results no matter who I talk to, how old they are. I mean, I've done it with Japanese scientists, French expatriates, Mexican dentists in one case, just folks. You know, I go to conferences, I do this, I get people to lie down, and then when they're finished, before they say anything, I say, but when the lights come up, before anything is said, very silently, you will find up at your head a form, and I want you to answer the questions on the form and fill them out. And that's what they do. And that's what's being entered into the database. But what they told me from the beginning was, for instance, which just completely dumbfounded me, was that the Soviet Union would disappear.
That's amazing.
And I thought, what do you mean it's going to disappear?
Yeah.
You know, somebody's going to come down and rip it up and take
right.
it away?
You think maybe an asteroid hits it or a bomb or something?
Exactly. I just couldn't figure out what they were talking about. Of course, it did disappear. They told me very early on, first of all, I was very concerned about nuclear war. And so I would say to them, has there been a nuclear holocaust? No, they would say. And I would say, oh, well, in the early days, before I got more sophisticated about it, I would say, oh, well, then the world must be a safer place. And they would say, no, the world is much more dangerous. And I said, why? Well, because of terrorism and all these wars that are being fought. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. I said, well, what else is dangerous? And they said, well, there are a number of pandemics that occur.
Amazing.
And I said, what do you mean pandemics? What? And the first one they said would be, they said it crossed over from primates in West Africa, and it's a blood disease, and it gets transmitted through people, and millions of people catch this and die.
Let's pick up right from there, Stephen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Plus, we'll also talk about the ability of self-healing.